Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Locked On Colts, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Today, I'm your host, Evan Sider. I'm joined by a very special guest today, Thor Nystrom of RotoWorld. How are you doing today, Thor?
I'm doing great. Good to be here.
Yeah, no problem at all. Appreciate you coming on today. And I wanted to get really started right away on the NFL draft. Before we even dive into our discussion today, Thor, what was your overall thoughts and your biggest takeaways from the 2019 NFL draft?
Oh, man, what a fascinating draft. You know, coming into this year, you go back a year, we knew it was going to be an awesome front seven class and that it was going to be sort of down in the offensive skill positions. And that proved to be true. And that was even before we knew that, you know, guys like Quinn and Williams were going to, you know, jump through the roof and stuff like that. And so it got even stronger. And that made for a very unpredictable draft, you know, as we got in there, both on Thursday night and then getting into Friday. But, you know, just the fact that you had, you know, all these guys in the front seven, you know, that were these sort of consensus top 15 prospects. And then there was, you know, these varying opinions on, you know, the quarterback class, but then also even, you know, the wide receiver class. I mean, you know, for the longest time, people thought DK Metcalf was going to be the top guy off the board, a top 15 pick. He was the last pick in the second round. Just all that kind of stuff. Daniel Jones going six, you know, sort of shook up the board. The NFL decided late that they were out on Haskins, so he falls down the board a little bit. Just all kinds of craziness. The Cardinals, you know, with Kingsbury deciding they wanted to go with Kyler and pulling the plug on the Josh Rosen era, given, you know, in my opinion, gifting the Dolphins a quarterback, you know, when outside of the first round, you know, on Friday. So, yeah, it was just a crazy, unpredictable, and very entertaining NFL draft.
Yeah, that defensive line class is pretty insane from this year. But I wanted to ask you about those quarterbacks specifically. Did you ever imagine, just if we're sitting here back in 2018, that a 5'10" quarterback and then a quarterback from Duke would be the first two quarterbacks taken in the 2019 draft?
No, not at all. No, I mean, coming into this year, Kyler Murray, he had his TDINT ratio was just about even for his career. All I'd seen him was struggling a bit as a true freshman at A&M when Kevin Sumlin kept toggling between him and Kyle Allen, and you know, Kyler got upset and transferred away, and then we really didn't see him for a few years. You know, obviously he had to do his transfer year, and then he was sitting behind Baker. So for him to ascend to the number one pick in the draft was stunning. For Kyler to be an NFL draft pick at all was stunning coming into this year. You know, I mean, it was just a done deal. He was going to be a baseball player. So that was pretty stunning. The Daniel Jones thing, that was very surprising too. If you told me before the season that Daniel Jones would get to six, that would not have surprised me nearly as much as the Kyler Murray stuff. But if you told me in, say, early September, or then, you know, as the season went on, that he would be, Daniel Jones, you know, broke his collarbone in early September, and then he came back and he couldn't throw deep. So I just thought, you know, at that point, he probably was going to, you know, be more of a latter end of the first round type prospect. I rated him 32 overall. But you kept hearing those whispers that a team in the top 15 had fallen in love with him. There was only two candidates. It was either the Giants or the Redskins. Turned out to be the Giants. So, yeah, just crazy.
Yeah, with Daniel Jones especially, I had more along the lines of you did, Thor, I think in the late 20s, early 30s, as far as my own personal big board goes. But I want to get your thoughts more on the quarterback situation in Arizona before we go into some more Colts discussion, overall draft talk. And it seems like you're a fan of Josh Rosen on the surface there. You think the Dolphins got a really good deal with the 62nd pick and the 5th-round pick for Josh Rosen. What do you think about the Cardinals drafting Josh Rosen, trading up for him a year later or year before, and then moving him out a year later for a guy like Kyler Murray? Who do you think won that trade on the surface?
Oh, Dolphins by far. Yeah, what an absolute steal. You know, and just the, you know, the Dolphins are famously incompetent franchise. For them to be sitting there waiting, you know, it's like they were at the bottom of a window and something got dropped all right into their laps, and they were there at least to catch it, to catch that opportunity. So good on them. They benefited from a whole bunch of things here. They benefited from the Cardinals locking on to Kyler, which I think it's a mistake. You know, I know I'm in the minority here, but I thought the Cardinals killed the rest of the draft. Every single pick, you know, from Byron Murphy through to the end to Caleb Wilson, Mr. Irrelevant, the UCLA tight end. He's going to do some stuff for Cliff, I think, as well. But you go back to that decision. I know it's easy for people to fall in love with Kyler and stuff like that and get excited. And I understand all that stuff. Kyler's super fun and everything like that. It's just, you know, with this roster that they have, would you rather have Josh Rosen and Quinn and Williams, you know, with the entire roster that they have, or would you rather have Kyler Murray and Andy Isabella? the Cardinals decided the latter, even though they have all these holes everywhere, you know, and the offensive line, I think, is going to become the most pressing one. But, you know, if it's me, I prefer to stay the course with Rosen because you get to keep all the draft capital. You know, why not fix the offensive line here, guys? You know, why not trade down? I don't know. Why not trade down to, you know, 8, 7, 8, 9, 10, whatever, you know, pick up Jonah Williams or heck, trade down a little bit later, pick up Andre Diller, pick up another offensive lineman. We could have fixed that, you know, as well. Or you could have just taken whatever stud front seven guy you wanted at the top of the board, you know, whether it was Quinnen or whether it was, you know, Josh Allen or Bosa or whoever you wanted to do. I would have stayed the course with that. You know, just it's a value thing. It's not about a prospect, you know, prospect apples to apples kind of thing. But I remain high on Rosen. I think, like I said, I think it's a steal of a deal for the Dolphins. I think there's multiple Pro Bowls in Josh Rosen's future. And I just, you know, for the public, it's just hilarious. And I was giggling about this a couple of years ago, and everyone was just, you know, after Jared Goff's first season, was just calling him garbage and stuff. You know, I'd watch this kid for, you know, 3 years at Sonny Dykes' air raid at Cal, and all of a sudden he's garbage because he goes to the NFL. He's playing for this moron, Jeff Fisher, and this, you know, on whatever the opposite word of innovative is, was their offensive staff, you know, and no supporting cast. And so Jared Goff struggles. Well, all of a sudden, Jared Goff's garbage. He shouldn't have even been drafted. He shouldn't be in the NFL. Like, let's ship him to the XFL or whatever. And then, of course, you know, the circumstances change. So Jared Goff's performance changes, which just makes sense. You know, there's the shifting of context. It shifts truth. Well, that's the same thing here with Rosen, you know, but people have forgotten, you know, and it's the same thing all over again. Rosen stinks, Rosen stinks, Rosen stinks. I don't think so. You know, he was not in a position to succeed last year. Understanding the context of the situation, understanding that that's not who he is. It was a contextual, circumstantial thing. I just thought it was really sharp for the Dolphins to sort of swoop in there.
What do you think, I guess, if we're looking ahead here, I think Josh Rosen's a great quarterback. I think he has the potential to be a really good quarterback. But if the Dolphins struggle next year and they have the chance to land Tua, do you think maybe Josh Rosen's back in the situation again, or do you think the Dolphins should stay put with him if he impressed them a little bit?
Well, that would be hilarious. Yeah, I mean, if because the Dolphins supporting cast so bad, they struggle again, and they're at the top of the board again, and he gets traded. I don't know. It would be very funny, you know, from an unintentional comedy perspective. But I would advocate next year, if the Dolphins essentially got into the same situation as the Cardinals did this year, I would advocate for the same thing. If Tua, you know, whether it's Tua or whether it's Justin Herbert, whatever guy ends as that consensus guy next year, fortunately for the teams that are going to be at the top of the board, you're going to have at least two, you know, guys up there that, you know, that are considered top five overall type quarterback prospects. So that draft pick is going to be worth quite a bit. So, you know, even more, I think, than the Cardinals pick this year. So, you know, if the Dolphins were in that situation, I would advocate that they stay the course, just like I did with the Cardinals this year, and trade down, you know, accrue all that draft equity and address all your other holes or whatever. It's Josh Rosen is not the issue here. You know, Josh Rosen is in, for me, he's in, and this was even coming into the league. You know, this isn't like a hindsight thing or whatever. Coming into the league, he's like a Kirk Cousins type, right? Like he sort of exists in that phylum where he's not a top, you know, 6-7 type quarterback in the league, but you know, you drop down to like that tier three or whatever, and people don't think that this is sexy or whatever, but there's 32 teams in the league, so you got to start 32 guys. So the 12th best starting quarterback in the NFL is very valuable. And guys like that, you know, the Rosen, the Cousins, stuff like that, you have to have a supporting cast around them. You know, you have to be able to protect them, number one, because, you know, both those guys' game is not mobility, you know, and so that's number one. And you also have to get them the receivers, you know, and that's what separates them, of course, from, you know, the Peyton Mannings and the Tom Brady's and the Drew Breeses that can sort of elevate the games of those around them. But as long as the pieces are fine around those guys, and hopefully, you know, I'm coming to you live from Minneapolis, and I'm a Vikings fan, so I'm sure hoping that they fix their, you know, the Vikings fix their offensive line to help out Cousins. But I think those factors are more important for a guy like Rosen than the issue being about Rosen himself. So I hope that whatever franchise he ends up on, hopefully it's the Dolphins going forward, that they will address those concerns instead of giving him absolutely no help and then claiming he's the problem.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I think Rosen was put in a really awful situation in Arizona. You had Mike McCoy as his offensive coordinator. That didn't go well. And then you had Byron Leftwich there, too. I think it just needs stability. That's the main thing with Josh Harris, and I think he'll be a great quarterback after that. But, Thor, let's pivot over here to our winners and losers. We'll start with the winners here. Who do you think, as far as maybe your top five, we'll just run through them here, who do you think are your biggest winners from the 2019 draft class?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, anyone out there, if you want to check out my draft grades on RotoWorld, go on over to the NFL draft section. I grade pretty hard. They put out on Twitter, they were putting out, you know, the different aggregated grades of all the national guys that put out draft grades, that I'm by far on the left because I grade on a curve. And basically what I'm trying to do is get my GPA, my cumulative GPA, to 2.5. I failed this year. It was 2.51, but I got pretty darn close. But, you know, I'm across the threshold, you know, with the grades. I give out Fs, I give out D minuses, I give out Ds, all that kind of stuff. But starting at the top of this thing, I gave out two A pluses this year to the Titans and to the Redskins. I thought those two teams absolutely killed it, pick by pick. The two A's I gave out were to the Chargers and to the Jets. And then I gave out five A minuses to the Cardinals, Browns, Jaguars, Patriots, and Eagles. So those would be my top classes.
Yeah, that's really interesting about the Redskins there. Since the Colts were involved in their pick for Montez Sweat, were you surprised to see the Colts move back from 26, even though they accrued that 2022nd? Would you have stayed on the board there if you're the Colts and maybe pick a guy like Montez Sweat or somewhere else?
Yeah, I wasn't necessarily surprised because I thought that the Colts might be targeting that cornerback. And in fact, I thought we might see Rock there in the first round. And I think, you know, the one thing I'll compliment the Colts on, you know, in this draft was reading the tea leaves on that one and knowing that the cornerbacks were going to get, you know, sort of shoved down the board a little bit. They knew that they could move back and still get a kid that they liked. So I definitely applaud that move of moving back. Now, I love the Montez Sweat pick. I absolutely love that. I think that kid should have gotten in the top 15. Now, I don't know his medicals. You know, I'm not privy to them. I don't get access to them or whatever. So I don't know how bad that heart condition is. But assuming that it was cleared by my team doctors, you know, that he wasn't going to be compromised, that this isn't something that could cut his career short, anything like that, he's absolutely a top 15 prospect for me. So, yeah, just in terms of value, I love that. But from the Colts perspective, I think that's, you know, they were very specifically wanted a specific position at the top there. And because of the way that the draft has fallen to them, they knew that they could hop back, accrue a bunch more draft equity, which is something that I'm a big fan of, you know, as is, like we were talking about with, like, you know, Kyler or Daniel Jones, you know, sort of, for me, is the opposite, is squandering of it. And in this case, it was sort of, you know, getting what you wanted, but also getting draft equity out of it.
Yeah, that's a really good point to bring up there. And I wanted to ask you this, as far as your other winners go with the AFC South, I feel like in the last 2 or 3 years, it's gotten really improved, and it's one of the more underrated divisions in the NFL. How do you feel like the Titans and the Jaguars and the Texans did? Because I know your grades, your snap grades, and you get the Colts the lowest one in the AFC South, but how do you believe that your other competition in the AFC South did?
Yeah, so, you know, as far as the Titans go, really, really like their class because they got Jeffrey Simmons in 19. Jeffrey Simmons is a kid that, for me, he's a top 10 talent in this class. And darn near would have been top five if not for the ACL and the off-field incident. I talk a lot about the off-field incident in my column. There were some contextual things that I think people weren't taking into consideration about that, not to excuse it, but that, you know, there are things that explain the background of that. And then the other thing people need to keep in mind is Jeffrey Simmons went to Mississippi State and was an absolute model citizen, model student, model everything. He was on the honor roll. He talked to kids. You know, he was on the leadership council. All this different stuff. He, you know, the coaches rave about him, his teammates rave about him, all that kind of stuff. And just a fabulously talented interior lineman. So getting him at 19, I thought was huge. AJ Brown at getting him in the second round at 51 overall is an absolute, I mean, that's highway robbery. That it's ridiculous that the NFL shoved him that far down the board. Like, that kid can absolutely play. Even if AJ Brown never develops again, he's worth the 51st pick and he's probably going to keep developing. So, and then Nate Davis, you know, Nate Davis is a solid pick. I think that was just sort of hitting a single there in the third round. That's about where I had him. Amani Hooker, man, another just absolute steal. He, in my opinion, should not have been available in the fourth round. DeAndre Walker was another guy. I ranked him in the third round. He ends up going in the fifth. And then David Long there, the linebacker they got out of West Virginia. I thought that was an inspired gamble too. as far as the Jaguars go, they had a really interesting draft because they got to take advantage of circumstance. And in circumstance, this case can be read as Dave Gettleman, you know, overdrafting the heck out of Mr. Daniel Jones. That shoved Josh Allen down the board. And so they had to, you know, the Jaguars had to take him. For me, I had Josh Allen ranked number two overall. He's available at 7. You throw your other plans out. You know, I'd been mocking the Jaguars, TJ Hawkinson, since February, since way before it was popular to, you know, to mock TJ Hawkinson in the top 10. I thought that that was such a great fit, you know, for Hawkinson and also for the organization. You know, I'm very, very high in TJ Hawkinson, obviously. But when, you know, and Hawkinson was available there, but there's no way you could have projected Josh Allen to be there. I did all these mock draft exercises during the process. Josh Allen didn't get the 7 once. And so when he gets down there, you got to say, man, we love you, Teach, but we're just going to accept the gift that the universe is giving us and take Allen. And then, you know, another guy that was talked about in that slot was Juwan Taylor. He ends up falling down the board. You know, there's rumors of a potential injury, you know, stuff like that. But, you know, I don't think it's anything that's going to linger on, in the future of his career or whatever. So for him to drop into the 35th slot, when some people were talking about him as a top 10, top 12 type pick, that was huge. And then I liked the rest of their draft as well. And the last team we were going to talk about was the Texans, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. So I gave them, and I think the Jaguars, I gave an A minus. I gave the Texans a B. The Texans had an awesome draft, except for in round one, which was very, very unfortunate for the Texans. And what was weird about it, and just to give people some background, obviously the Texans came into this thing badly needing offensive line. I mean, they sort of had the draft profile in the AFC that my Vikings did in the NFC, where they were just, it was earmarked. You have to take an offensive lineman at least in round one, you know, if not, you know, with also with your second pick or whatever. And so we all knew that that's the way that they were looking. And Andre Dillard was the bonanza, you know, I thought for both the Vikings and for them, but the Vikings ended up getting Bradbury, which, you know, also a bonanza scheme fit for them or whatever. But Dillard ends up falling way below where he should have fallen. And I had been told in the pre-draft process by someone close to Dillard that the Texans loved him. And this guy was telling me, he said, watch out for the Texans trading up, you know, to secure Dillard. And so I was like, oh, okay. Well, then Dillard falls down to the Vikes, and obviously, you know, I'm a huge, huge Dillard fan, and so I was hoping that they take him. They took Bradbury, which was, you know, entirely understandable, but then, you know, that means that Dillard starts falling down a little bit more, and so I'm like, man, the Texans are going to trade up. You know, my buddy, you know, they're obviously going to trade up. It's not even going to cost that much now, and then Dillard gets one pick in front of him, and it's like, all right, Texans, do it now. You know, you only need to give up two late day three picks or whatever to get up a spot. Just do it. And they didn't. And, you know, the thing comes on like trade announcement, and I'm like, oh, man, the Texans did it. Good for them. And then it comes up that the Eagles did it, you know, and hopped them or whatever. And I just thought that was so poorly done by the Texans. Dillard was right there for you. And all you would have had to do, I think, you know, looking at the trade that the Eagles, ended up making for that pick, I think that the Texans only would have had to give up their 5th and 6th round picks to move up that one slot. But they get usurped by the Eagles, and, you know, the Eagles hop them for Dillard. And then all of a sudden, you know, the Texans are like, oh, crap. You know, it was like with the Bengals last year when they wanted Frank Ragnow in the first round, and they get, you know, the Lions unexpectedly take Ragnow right above them. And the Bengals are just like, oh, crap, what do we do? What do we do? What do we do? Okay, who's the next center on our board? Okay, let's call in Billy Price. And it seems like that's what happened with Tytus Howard. Outside of that, though, so I hated what they did in the first round, the Texans. That was really poorly done. But after that, I thought they just destroyed it. I mean, and they got several guys that I was very, very high on, like, you know, plant the flag kind of guys. So I love the rest of their draft. I just didn't like the first round. So that would be my rundown of the division.
Yeah, as far as the AFC South goes, they definitely reloaded, and they're going to give the Colts a good run for their money next year as far as the AFC South goes, with everyone else really getting better throughout this draft class. But Thor, let's pivot over here to your biggest loser of the draft class. Who do you have as far as your top five for your biggest losers?
So my two Fs were the Raiders and the Cowboys. Those two fan bases aren't very happy with me right now. I gave a D- to the Dolphins, but I'll say, you know, my grades I do not bake trades into them. I think it gets too wonky. You know, you go down too many like alternate realities. You have to follow these trades back or whatever. For me, it's just about picks in the slot. You know, that's what my grades are. So Josh, the Josh Rosen thing, that's not involved in there. I'm just, you know, the picks that you're making with the slots that you have, are you getting value there? Are you filling your needs, et cetera? With the picks the Dolphins made, I didn't like them. So, you know, I gave them a D minus. And then I'm really sorry, Colts fans, but moving up to a D, my two Ds were Colts and Giants.
Let me ask you more about the Colts then. What stood out to you as far as why they deserve such a low grade?
You know, this has something to do with the form of draft grades on their own, is that, of course, my grades are based on my pre-draft work on these prospects and where I rank them, right? And so if a team just so happens to take, let's say, four or five guys that I happen to be lower on than the industry consensus, I am naturally going to grade that team lower. Now, they, you know, Colts fans right now say, you idiot, you think you're smarter than Ballard? No, I do not think I'm smarter than Ballard. I am not omniscient. I did do the work on the players, though. I went 500 deep in my rankings, and I researched all of them, watched all of them. And just with my read on it in the pre-draft process, I had a lot of the guys that the Colts picked lower for reasons that we can get into. So it was solely about that. Although, you know, again, I'll give another caveat. I mean, I am not smarter than Ballard. Again, I'll say that. I hated the Darius Leonard pick last year. And it was about, I think it was mid-September when I watched the Colts game, and I'm like, man, you dope. You missed on that one pretty bad, didn't you? And then in early October, I made amends for it, where I found a prop where it was, I think I got 3-1 on Darius Leonard, a prop to win Defensive Rookie of the Year. And so I figured that was my amends to the universe, was by laying it on Darius, and he cashed it out for me. So I appreciated that. Thanks, Darius.
Hey, there you go. That definitely makes up for it there. So as far as we can go into more detail now about the Colts picks, since you have them lower than consensus, who do you stand out to you as far as the lowest on your board that maybe the Colts reach for on your own personal one?
For me, I would say probably Banagu. I think Banagu was a guy where I was just way lower on him than almost everybody else. I watch a lot of Big 12 football for work. For folks out there, I don't cover the NFL. I cover college football. It's what I do year round up until, you know, after the national title game through, you know, the middle of May or whatever, I'm NFL draft. And then I go back to college football. And I specifically cover a lot of the Big 12 and the Big 10. And so I watch those guys, you know, watch a crap ton of their games throughout their careers. But Naga was a kid I was extremely excited about. You know, heading into a couple years ago, heading into like 2017, whatnot, he'd been a kid who was overlooked, you know, Texas kid who'd been overlooked, a toolsy kid, similar, by the way, in some ways, in terms of his recruiting process to Hakeem Butler, who happened to be in Texas, you know, during that time as well. Hakeem had moved from Baltimore down there, but he was another overlooked guy who had, you know, tremendous size and athleticism, but was just extremely raw. And so those big Texas programs overlooked him. Hakeem obviously ended up going to Iowa State, and Banagu, he couldn't even get a P5 offer. So he had to go to UL Monroe. He dominated in year one. And then, you know, the schools around the country were like, oops. And Banagu wanted to stay home. So he went to TCU. His career was solid. But for me, when I was watching the games and stuff like that, it never completely lived up to where I wanted it to be. There are a few specific holes in his game. And this is going to be very interesting for me, you know, as far as like evaluating, because I'm always looking for where I made mistakes. You know, Darius Leonard, that was an important lesson to me. And so there was some rangy type linebackers in this class that I moved up merely because of that mistake, you know, where, you know, you're looking for some stuff like that. So I'm always, you know, looking to course correct and stuff like that. And, you know, maybe this is a case where, you know, I'm making the same mistake twice, you know, with Banagu. But my issue with him is he's an edge defender who struggles very much with power, and he can get jarred off his path pretty easy too. It's not like you got to square him up to maul him down. you know, he you know, in terms of like contact balance and stuff like that off the edge, it's just not the best. And so he was able to beat, you know, some of these mediocre Big 12 tackles with speed, stuff like that off the edge. But he struggled more when he was engaged. And so like for those reasons, I'm just a little bit lower on him. Also the, he's sort of older as a prospect. He just turned 23 in January. So he's going to be 24 at the end of his rookie season. So for those reasons, I do have a bit of concern, but I also understand why people like him and why the Colts liked him. Obviously the athleticism is insane. You know, he's in the 97th percentile of edge defenders at the combine, led the Big 12 in quarterback pressures last year with 60, had 28 run stops. So he also led in that. I don't think he's going to be a plus run defender in the NFL, but he did do that, you know, and so there is a proof of concept on, you know, at least as far as that goes, to give the counterpoint. And he was productive in college. But to go back to my issue, I just wonder how that game is going to translate, because for me, you know, he was very up and down at TCU. He was inconsistent and he struggled with this one specific thing. And in college, you'll see this, you know, every year or so, where you'll have these guys that can put up big time stats because they're just longer and faster than everyone they're going up against. But once they have to engage, and Banagu he's not running around anyone in the NFL. It's not going to happen. So now he's going to have to be confronted with this big weakness of his. He can't just take it off the table by out-athleticing you. And so we'll see if he can do it. But that was my trepidation with Banagu, and that's why I ended up dropping him beneath some other edge defenders where I'm more comfortable that, you know, up the floor, basically. The risk profile for me was mitigated in these other situations.
I'm curious to your thoughts about this, Thor, because Chris Ballard said in his post-draft press conference that he was actually going to move Banagu from edge to Sam. He thought his rangy speed reminded him a little bit of Jamie Collins. What do you think about him moving to linebacker?
Okay, that I think is brilliant. I had not heard that before. What's really funny about that is I considered and in fact, I believe in my first draft, I actually ranked Banagu with the linebackers. And I got on Twitter, I got some comments about like, why don't you have Banagu on edge? Why don't you have Banagu on edge? And, you know, the reason was because like Banagu was better in coverage, like in some of these other things, you know, that are more, you know, typically off ball type traits or whatever, than you would think. He was better at the things that like people did not discuss than he was with the edge rushing thing. Like, you know, his edge rushing, the stats look great, but you gotta understand, like, Gary Patterson's one of the best defensive coaches in America, and he was sending Banagu all the time, you know, putting him in the best spots, whatever. They were trying to leverage his strengths against, you know, basically the opposing team's like slowest tackle off the edge there. So it's like, you know, you have a pitcher in college baseball that can throw 102 miles per hour. Well, you're never really going to develop his changeup and his curveball or whatever, because he could just blow it by everybody. But yeah, I went through that thought experiment probably like in mid-March or something, where it's just like, is Banagu actually an off-ball linebacker, but just nobody realizes it? That is really interesting. Thanks for telling me that, because I did not know that anyone else in the NFL had that thought. And it's not surprising that it's Ballard. And it's also not surprising that, you know, he pushed him up for those reasons, because maybe some of these other teams that were viewing him as a traditional edge had some of these same concerns that I did. Like, how is Banagu going to beat some of these, you know, power tackles in the NFL that also can slide in front of him? It's just sort of hard to project. But yeah, you weaponize his athleticism and his length out there, where he can cover, he can run around, he can go sideline to sideline, stuff like that. That might be a better use of his skill. So yeah, that's pretty interesting.
Let me ask you as well, Thor, about the first pick they had at pick 34. They moved back, still got their guy they coveted. Evan Silva mentioned he was the top cornerback on their board. Rocky Sin of Temple.
Yeah, Rocky Sin's very interesting. He's another guy that I had just a bit lower. I ranked him 49th overall. The Colts took him 34th. I'm not going to quibble with that at all. You know, that's fine, you know, because he's their guy. He's a better scheme fit. That's close enough for me in the range, right? I don't consider that a reach at all. The reason that I did have him a bit lower than some other folks is my questions with Rocky. So, you know, I'm talking to a Colts audience, so you guys probably know all this, you know, by now, but you know, he, first 3 years of his career was at the D2 level, Then he transfers up as a grad to Temple. So he was only in, you know, the FBS for one season, and it was at the G5 level, you know, in the American Conference, where they didn't really face NFL receivers. And so Rocky is this guy, like, you know, average athleticism, average speed, you know, he's not, you know, decidedly not top notch in either, but in the AAC, you know, his game is based basically on physicality, and man, he roughed up some receivers on the outside there at the AAC, and just erased people, you know. So he was just utterly dominant. He allowed a 53% completion rate last year, 62.1 passer rating when targeted. I think, you know, people probably know this stat because it was one of the most sterling ones on his sheet. Didn't give up a single reception over 20 yards. And he was also just rarely tested deep. There was only 9 targets that ended up going that far. 0 completions again out of those. He led the AAC in pass breakups and stuff like that. So he was extremely dominant. My whole thing though is, you know, and again, you know, Ballard obviously has a different idea on this, you know, than I do, and should probably be trusted more than me. But, you know, when I think about Rakia, I think, you know, you were able to mug all these AAC receivers that did not have the athleticism to beat you deep, which is the one thing where when you're projecting Rakia, you're like, well, man, okay, so this guy is extremely raw, extremely raw. I mean, he needs technical refinement very bad. And then he also lacks that high-end athleticism. And you just start to wonder, like in college, there was no receiver that he was confronted with that could take advantage of those potential weaknesses. They could never sort of call him out on it, you know. And so Rakia basically was just free to just do his mugging thing, you know, and just play physical and knock these guys around or whatever, and no one could do anything against him. But I wonder if he is against one of those tall tree burners on the outside in the NFL, how he's going to handle that, because it's not just the deep speed thing, right? Like, if, you know, once Rakia knows, oh man, okay, this guy across from me is bigger than, he's taller than me, he's bigger than me, and he's faster than me. Now Rakia, now he's got to play a little bit further back, right? Like, he can't play his whole game up. He can't try to press him, whatever. Like, he needs a little bit of, he needs to compensate a little bit so he doesn't get torched. Well, then I get concerned about if that stuff starts to happen. I was already, some of these AAC receivers, they could get him sort of like, the way that I put it was sort of like rocking back, like in a rocking chair. Some of the smaller, like shiftier guys, you know, when he was in the intermediate area, because again, the footwork is not there yet. And so like, if he has to start compensating for one of, you know, something like that, and all of a sudden they can start using the compensation against him as well, you know, in the intermediate area too, that was my concern. Now, I still rated him as a mid-second round pick. It's not like I disliked the kid. In fact, I like him quite a lot. You know, coaches fall in love with him. Everyone that went down to Mobile, you know, at the Senior Bowl, everyone fell in love with Rakia. Like, just a great attitude, you know, competitor, everything like that, play style. You know, he's one of the few corners that your eye sort of gets drawn to him on the field because he's such a fighter. I just wonder about that translation. And so, you know, for me, it's very similar to Banagu. The risk profile for me just ended up being higher than some other guys in the industry. And because of that, I had to move a couple of corners over him that I was more comfortable with because I thought, you know, that they were less risky selections.
One more prospect I want to hit on with you, Thor, before I let you go. Appreciate the time as always. Is Paris Campbell of Ohio State. And I know Colts fans, I think this is the most excited pick the Colts fans have right now because they imagine him alongside a Funchess, a Hilton, an Eric Ebron, Jack Doyle, and imagine a lot of possibilities with a guy, Paris Campbell. What's your thoughts on him?
Yeah, another one I was just a bit lower on. I had Paris 76th overall. He went with the 59th overall pick in the second round. Obviously, crazy athletic, you know, 99th percentile athleticism, you know, at 6'2", 205, you know, he's a well-built kid too. So I understand all that. He's also an awesome kick returner. You know, he was one of the Big Ten's better kick returners. So, and last year he went nuts, you know, 88 catches, 1,062 yards, 12 touchdowns. My issue with him is, well, it's a couple different things. He can't catch balls downfield. He made 2 catches in over his entire career, folks. This wasn't last year. This is over his entire time in Columbus. He had 2 catches over 20 yards downfield. For me, that's a little bit troubling. He also doesn't make contested catches. Over the last 2 seasons where he saw a ton of targets, keep in mind, you know, near 200 targets last couple of seasons combined, he had 9 contested catches and 17 opportunities. for, you know, the speed guys in this class, that was on the very bottom of the spectrum. So he's, the way that I see him is it's sort of like in the NBA with like a 3-point specialist where Paris cannot manufacture his own space. The touches and the space need to be manufactured for Paris. If he gets both of them though, you know, if it is manufactured for him, he can get on that runway and get into the end zone very quickly. But he's, you know, I think because of those limitations, he's a, you know, a gadget type slot guy, you know, or it's a lot of like flat routes and stuff like that. Like it's a lot of stuff in the short area. He's basically a you know, more running back than receiver where, but his handoffs have to come on the perimeter. So, you know, you put him on the phylum of like, you know, Percy Harvin and Curtis Samuel and Tavon Austin, like, you know, guys like that or whatever. I think he's a bigger Curtis Samuel. So that is worth something. You know, again, I had him as like a third round type guy or whatever, but there are other receivers in this class that could do more things. And so for those reasons, that's why I put him down, just because I see him as more of like a gadget type guy.
I'd be remiss not to ask you this question, Thor. Did you have EJ Speed in your top 500? Because I had no idea who that was when they drafted him.
No, I did not. He was the I think there was five guys that weren't. But it's funny because the name jogged something in my memory, and so I looked him up, and he was the kid that got arrested for the I don't know if it was a syndicate or whatever the heck the thing was. The charges were eventually dropped, but it was a strange pick because that's the kind of pick you make in the seventh round. You know, I don't know who, and who knows, maybe Ballard and those guys, maybe they knew of other teams that were sniffing around EJ Speed in the sixth round. Certainly Speed fits, the Colts sort of prerogative. I mean, Ballard loves to draft these sort of rangy athletic linebackers or whatever. So I understand the dart throw. It just seemed kind of odd when there was like a whole bunch of other guys on the board that had sort of proven track records and didn't have the risk profile, you know, on any metric. You know, they hadn't been arrested for, you know, criminal activities, and but also that they, you know, they've proven the concept in the FBS and stuff like that, whereas EJ Speed hadn't. But, you know, as far as just the project that you're gonna throw a dart on, he is interesting. You know, he's a kid who was a former quarterback, former wide receiver. He's very productive last year at Tarleton. So, worth a dart throw, I suppose. For me, it's a little bit early, but heck, it's late day three, and Ballard knows what he's doing, so why not?
Thor, before I let you go here, one last question for you. What's your overall thoughts on the Colts and their draft strategy the last two or three years under Chris Ballard?
Man, you can't argue with it. That guy gets it done. And it's the kind of thing where, you know, I was afraid to give the Colts a D because Chris Ballard is so sharp and his team is so sharp. You're sort of going against these guys who have proven to be the smartest guys in the room. But, you know, on the other hand, I'll say no team dominates every draft. They don't. We have some analytical guys at work who have run some studies on this where it appears that the way that evaluators differentiate themselves from each other is in the first round. And then the relative success of picks after that goes down where it becomes sort of statistically insignificant. And ergo, there can be, front offices that you think are elite because they have a couple good draft classes out of the gate. Tend to regress. And so, you know, I'm not saying that that's what's going to happen here, but, I don't know. I didn't love having to grade them that low because, you know, I do think it's such a sharp organization. And the Colts have a guy who's from my little hometown of Brainerd, Minnesota, and Joe Haig. So I root for the Colts anyhow. But, we'll see how it goes. They've certainly proven the concept themselves.
Hey, Thor, this is really fun. I appreciate the time. If you guys want to follow Thor on Twitter, it's @ThorKu, @ THORKU. Thor, appreciate the time.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.